Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We're here to give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., and 1 a.m. Monday mornings. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we also link to our guests' website so that you can get more information about what we will be talking about with our guest today over the next hour or so. You'll be able to find out even more than what we're going to have time to cover. And I have to tell you that on this program, we are literally only going to be scratching the surface. I know that from the outset, because the subject we're going to be talking about today is enormous. It is just something that has affected all of our lives in one way or another, and generations, quite honestly, several thousand years, if not longer. But it's still impacting us today. What am I talking about? Well, today we're going to be talking with not only an author, but an activist as well as an attorney who has been involved in the process of trying the very best that he can with his resources and his abilities and his skills and the love that he has for humanity to try to not necessarily bring about world peace, but try to bring about peace wherever he is. We're talking with Frank Romano. He's the author of the fourth edition of Love and Terror in the Middle East. What does this have to do with New Paradigms for a New World? Well, Frank is a part of those new paradigms. He's trying to help to bring those about. Frank, first of all, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My privilege, Richard. Thanks for inviting me on the program. I appreciate it.
You know, we've had a chance to chat prior to this, and of course, I remember bringing up the subject, of course, of September 11th, 2001, and I remember watching the images at, it must have been like 5:30, 6 o'clock or something like that, local time when I was living in Phoenix, and two things went through my mind. The first thing was, there's something not right here. Something is askew, not from the standpoint of, oh my God, look at what is happening, and this is unbelievable. No, it was like, I can accept what's happening, but there's something wrong here as far as who's responsible, as far as how this all unfolded. And we're not here to talk pro or con about 9/11. We're here to talk about, of course, the whole underlying tension that's been going on, as I mentioned earlier, for thousands of years, not just in that part of the world, but around the world, because of these the three. Would I be amiss in saying three rival religions, competitive religions? Is that an unfair statement?
It's not unfair, Richard, because unfortunately, the way Christians, Muslims, and Jews are taught, and sometimes the way they worship, tends to create barriers, and it becomes then, we're going to heaven, you're not. Not always, but and of course, different Christian, you can look at just the Christians. You look all the way from the Southern Baptist, you can go to the Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Muslims, not necessarily in that same category, all the way to the very liberal, Unitarian, and then some of the Baha'is and Sufis, all across. You see that there are, you can even say that there are rivals among Christians, there are rivals among Muslims, the Sunnis and Shia, and go even deeper in it. And that shouldn't be. But I don't think it's unreasonable to say that they feel, many Muslim, Jews, and Christians, they are rival religions, and that often they feel that they are in the superior position. They're going through the pearly gates, and unfortunately the others aren't, and it shouldn't really be that way.
You know, as a student of comparative religions myself, unofficially, working for a Christian radio station for 15 years, I came to the conclusion, rightly or wrongly, I came to this conclusion about the various sects of Christianity, which I can speak to because that's what I was born and raised in. Whenever I hear comment or commentary about the level of persecution toward that individual, that particular sect of Christianity or Christianity at large. The best metaphor I could come up with was, the only reason you are being persecuted is because the analogy is of a train on a train track. And it's because you choose to stand on the tracks and accuse the train of persecuting you. If you would just step off the tracks, you would be just fine. And I don't know if that's a fair analogy or not, but that was my observation back then, that, you know, individuals who choose to be antagonistic and so on and so forth, and I even see this in the political realm as well, and other areas as well, that, you know, you're being attacked, really? Well, what did you do to precipitate the aggression towards you? You know, what train, by whatever name, did you just stand in front of? And you expected not to get hit? And that's kind of the way I look at some of this, these folks with maybe, I don't know, well-meaning hearts, it's hard to say, they claim that they're being persecuted by everybody else, which then they use to justify the position that they take. That, see, we're being persecuted, and we're supposed to be persecuted because that's what the prophecies say and those kinds of things. Do you see that?
Well, it's the only way I can see it is if we have specific examples, because I'm not sure if I really get the analogy with the train. It seems like I'm not criticizing or judging it. Each situation is so different that to make it a general metaphor like that, mm-hmm. I think is pretty inapplicable.
Okay.
But if we could. Having precise examples, I'm sure that applies to different situations, but I'd have to see it because it's so different. And I'm just making a general commentary, Richard,
sure.
That people have a tendency of generalizing, and actually, like United Americans have in particular, the way we're educated, have a tendency of judging things based upon our Western eyes. And it often is askew because we don't get into the shoes or get into the particular situation, and we just make a blanket generalization. So that could be, maybe I'm just not getting the metaphor. And if you give me a specific example, then I think I'd understand better, because I've found in my studies and in my grassroots efforts going back and forth for the last 10 years, three or four times a year and sometimes more into Israel and the West Bank, that my sweeping generalization, even my grand metaphors, have been pretty well torn down one by one by the intricacies and the nuances of different cultures and religions and the way things actually are. That I'm pretty well falling back from generalizing. Some metaphors definitely applied. That one, I'm just not sure.
Okay. And again, First of all, I am willing to have that one torn apart and tossed to the side. And number two, I mean by no means any disrespect to anybody in that regard. Mm. And it may very well be, as you just explained, that my metaphor is a creation of my own exclusive westernization, and I want to broaden that understanding. I don't want to stay in that mindset any further, because as long as I and others like myself stay in that mindset, how are we ever going to solve some of these issues, some of these conflicts? And that's kind of what we're here to talk about today. You have been all over the Middle East, among other places. You have dealt with people's from so many different cultures and ideologies and so forth, philosophies, as I like to say. And I think you're absolutely right from the standpoint that we have got to be more specific. I remember posing this question shortly after, maybe a year or so after 9/11, and then all the fervor and everything. And I was kind of putting the question out there, has anybody bothered to sit down and talk with these people? If there is a representative that we could talk with and say, why are you so pissed off? What has got you so angry that you're willing to die for this philosophy? And Nobody has, as far as I know, has anybody?
And no, well,
have you?
No, not at first. I'll tell you, I just basically said, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that person's been brainwashed and all this and all that. And this is basically, it's like the suicide bombers from Palestine into Israel. They usually have the same profile. They're poor, easily manipulated. They're going through a depression, and so easier to convince that if you put these bombs on your waist and drink this liquid and you kill some infidels, you'll go to paradise. If you look at the people that were piloting these planes that crashed in to the towers in 9/11, I think all, without exception, were university-educated, intelligent people. You look at their past a little bit. I studied their past as I was unbelieving. But in my experience, Richard, I've seen not just Muslims. I've seen Christians, very intelligent people, get, for some reason, the leaders of that particular religious group realize that person is vulnerable, intelligent or not intelligent, and finds a weak point and then gets a way into that person's heart or in that person's mind, and that person becomes a kind of fanatic, extremist, and yet person is generally a very intelligent person. I've seen Christians, I've seen Jewish people that I've known that have become very, very, very rigid in their thinking with it, or in the Orthodox approach. I'm not saying all Orthodox Jews are rigid, and so now I'm beginning to realize that there's something there, and there's something behind. And I did ask the question, and I had to look further. I know you have too, Richard, because this thing that happened on 9/11, it didn't stand up, and I had to understand what is the mindset of most Muslims in the world, and I had to get behind it. I was in denial over it until I finally realized it. And then on dealing with specific incidences, which I could go into, I understand it. I don't think a lot of things are justified, obviously, but understanding the mindset is part of the way. It's maybe half of the way there. One doesn't understand the mindset or even ask the question that you just asked, Richard, then you're launching in the wrong way. You're getting off on a bad start.
Yeah.
And from then on, you're going down a twisted route, and it often leads you to the wrong conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I would say, well, what have I done, or what have we done in the West? People can start listing all kinds of things that we've done. Yes. I have to say that, you know, I'm not, you know, and I get a little perturbed when I hear extreme patriotism criticizing those who, quote unquote, hate America. They're doing nothing but pointing out America's flaws. Well, the reality is, if we don't take a look at our flaws, we're never going to improve. And there's a lot about the West and democracy that has got real problems. And when I hear us using the phrase, and I say us, our government, using the phrase that we're going to export democracy around the world, I shudder for the people we're going to export it to. It's like they don't deserve that because we haven't perfected it yet. And when we do, if we do and when we do, then I say, let's do it. And if they want it, let them come here and get the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. Let them come here and learn about it and take it back and make it the way, form it in the way that they want to, and not force it upon them. And that's what seems to have happened over the years, even over the centuries, with different rulers, different kingdoms, that, you know, they start to expand their kingdom, and you're going to live this way or you're going to die.
Now, if I can interject something here and get into absolute specifics.
Yes.
I have come to the conclusion, and now linked to what you said about exporting democracy, is absolutely relevant to how I'm going to kind of break things down now.
Yes.
I think the mindset of most Muslims is, whether it's justified or not, you still have to get into the mind, the mindset. For some reason, a lot of Muslims feel that there is a global attack against Islam. Whether that be a liberal or an Orthodox or an extremist Muslim, many of them feel that. Now, you ask, is it what? It's not possible, and I absolutely disagree with their conclusion. But it's in their mind. How did it get in their mind? Well, look at the Gulf War, and I'm going to tie in that exportation of democracy into that Gulf War, which was one of our government, U.S. government's operandi, modus operandi, was to export democracy there. So sort of what happened, if you can analogize to what happened in Japan after Japan was, a lot of it was destroyed after the nuclear weapon, after the World War II and the atomic bombs. And they kicked in because it was already set up in their own type of work ethic mentality and became incredible competitors. Democracy, not as you could argue, well, there's no real democracy in the U.S. either. Over a Republican form of government, they do have that in Japan. Is it equivalent to ours? Perhaps not as representative, but still, it's no longer a fascism. It's no longer Hirohito there. And economically, they jumped in and became not only efficient, but competitors in many U.S. markets. And we became interdependent. Now we said, well, you know, let's go into Iraq. I think it was official that the U.S. government felt that with getting rid of the dictator and bringing in an economic infrastructure, it'll just, you know, they'll just, you know, plug right in to the system. People will no longer be open to extremists because they'll have jobs. It'll be more of an open market system like the U.S., and we'll find stability there, as in Japan and other countries that the United States was involved in. Well, keep that in our back burner, because that addresses what you just stated. And then we'll go to that, back to that overall idea by Muslims that there's an attack against Islam. Well, the United States support, and again, I don't think it's not justified. There's not a global attack against Islam, but it's in their minds. And one example is our unbridled support of Israel, you know, and the persecution of Italian of Palestinians in the West Bank, this taking their lands with unbridled economic support by the U.S. and the blockade of Gaza in the Palestine, and most Palestinians are Muslim. There are many Palestinian Christians, but most are Muslims. They feel, well, here's just another example of the Western kind of bullies ganging up on us, the Muslims. And then the two Gulf Wars was seen as, well, yes, there are a lot of Arab Muslims in the world that didn't like Saddam Hussein, but it seems like here we have, of course, the liberation of Kuwait was definitely justified going in there and kicking out Saddam Hussein and making it in a much worse situation, far more vulnerable. And that's when ISIS came in. We can go into the detail there. Many Muslims feel this is just the general global attack by Western countries against Muslim countries, whether it be Sunni or Shiite, not to mention what's our relationship with Iran and other countries. And it's in their heads. And the question is, how do you change that? We need to obviously improve upon our approach on one hand, that our diplomacy, our diplomats are highly inefficient under Clinton and others. And you know, they didn't understand the mentality. Condoleezza Rice, when I was jogging in Ramallah in the West Bank, was trying to, for posterity, she was trying to get something going for posterity, she was anticipating leaving office. As Secretary of State was going shuttling back and forth, thinking that she could somehow trigger some type of a peace solution there, and without much understanding, and Condoleezza Rice, the Palestinians knew her. I mean, she was very hawkish before, and now all of a sudden she's handing out olive. She's reaching out with olive branches. It's very difficult for them to adjust. The thing, well, she was very hawkish. A very pro Iraq war, not really into peace, is very pro-Israeli. To them, you're pro-Israeli, then you're pro-occupation, taking our lands. They thought that you're changing, you know, she's like your little Red Riding Hood in a wolf in grandmother's clothing. Mm-hmm. I'm attacking different things. I'm saying our diplomacy, understanding of that culture, where they're coming from, and they're working from there, and not at all putting them all together, all countries that have economic issues, and under Saddam Hussein, there were great disparities, the poor and the rich, and he favored, obviously, people coming from his sect. And we felt, we're going in there, we're going to export our democracy. It does not work with some cultures. We have to get into their culture to figure out why, because they're very, very attached to their religion and their culture, and you just don't go in there the slam bam thank you ma'am type of a approach to a very delicate situation and export a democracy that's inapplicable the way we see it. So I think you're absolutely right in saying that. And the Shah also found that out. Remember, the Shah of Iran wanted switch Iran so quickly into a Western country, and you know, no headscarves, very, you know, tempering the idea of religion being a part of it. And the people said, but we're still attached to it. And that gave rise to the revolution and opened the door to a fanatic like Khomeini. And they made the same mistake of we have tried to do to export democracy. As you said, we haven't perfected it, but it doesn't mean that we can't share good parts of it. And there are many good parts of our country and our democracy that we can share and continue improving on the parts that need improvement, but not to a wholesale think that we're going to put it all in all these countries that are depressed in one basket and say all they need is our help and improve the economic infrastructure. People get jobs and they'll throw the extremists out and they'll be happy and it'll work out and they'll become competitors in the market, become, you know, economically solvent like Japan. It doesn't work with all cultures. So getting back to the, and I don't want this to be a monologue, getting back to this overall feeling of attack against Muslim is a reality. It's in their heads. We need to work far more on our diplomacy with different countries, and especially the Arab countries, showing that we understand the culture. We're not going to impose, but our unbridled support of Israel is a real difficult point that we need to think about. I think we need to place conditions upon our help to show to Israel, to show that we don't, we verbally say we do not like the fact, even just Netanyahu said we're going to add 4,500 apartments to the settlements. All of them under international law are considered illegal. They're not illegal in my mind, because they're even members of my family. As I said, I had Jewish roots in Hebron, bought the land and set up a yeshiva in Hebron. That is their land. But for the most part, the Jews in the West Bank, in the settlements, are on taken land that has been considered and judged illegal by International Court of Justice. But in any case, getting back to all that, you know, and you've hit upon it. This is the specific example I'm thinking of, you know, when we're talking about persecution and you're thinking about, well, just get off the track and then you'll be better. Well, if you get into the detail of the thing, the question is, how do you get off the track? It becomes very complicated and very nuanced. But maybe that's a general, you know, that feeling of persecution, getting back to your metaphor, and that now I'm going to justify that metaphor. If it's in the mindset, you have that persecution-oriented mindset, it's hard to move forward. It's hard to progress. It's hard to see otherwise. And that's going to be up to us, in particular Western countries, the way we approach different cultures, different religions. And, you know, and one of the thing about persecution, I just said, was a specific example. But I think that metaphor generally, that persecution theory, the Israeli Jews use that a lot. You know, that Holocaust persecution, we're persecuted, we're surrounded, this is all for security. And a lot of people, and it's found even by the Israeli Supreme Court, that a lot of those settlements, some of those settlements were actually made to take Palestinian lands and not for security, but they also feed on this feeling that, well, coming from the Holocaust, coming from the concentration camps, we're persecuted and people hate us, so we need to circle the wagons, and taking land is just part of our security. So I'm just adding specific examples to that metaphor, trying to clarify the mindset and what we need to do. And I don't know if you agree with that or if you want to.
Well, no, first of all, I appreciate that, but it brings to mind something else that here in the United States is quite prevalent. Back in, I think it was the 80s or very early 90s, might have been the late 80s, in Arizona, where I was born and raised, and I was working for a station there. The big controversy at the time under Governor Bruce Babbitt was that the Native Americans in the area wanted to build casinos on the reservation, and I had always learned that the reservations and the peoples that live there, that were in essence put there, that the reservation was sovereign land. That the Native Americans, they had self-determination in that respect. And so now all of this comes up, and it's like, well, wait a minute. The Native Americans, they want to have gambling on the reservation. What's the problem? And of course, the whole argument came up. And I was even interviewing a gentleman about this subject. He was opposed to the compact. And I said, okay, all right, let's take off the table gambling. Let's take the casinos off of the table. If they can't have casinos on the reservation to raise money, what can they do? And on the other end of the phone came nothing but silence. And that's kind of, I kind of feel like that's sort of the, I want to say, hypocrisy that exists, that we're unwilling to actually have genuine dialogue, is that we set up a set of rules as the government does, and then says, yeah, but we're going to do whatever we want because you're within, you know, you're within our framework, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I'm you know, being somewhat flippant and paraphrasing and what have you, but that's my observation, that it's like, well, wait a minute, either they're sovereign or they're not. Either they govern themselves or they not. And yet we have, what do we have, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, an agency of the federal government that supposedly oversees them. What overseeing do they need? They're a sovereign nation. Each tribe and the reservation is a sovereign nation. Well, When I take a look at, for example, Israel and Palestine, or the Israelis and the Palestinians, between you and me and I was going to say the fence post, but everybody else that's listening, I'll be honest with you, if I met two individuals in a room, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you who was who. I couldn't. They probably could, because there are certain characteristics maybe that they would be able to deter. I couldn't do it, you know, any more than I could determine an individual from one Russian country versus another Russian country. You know, after the breakup of the USSR, you know, you have all these different nations, and you know, you're from Czechoslovakia and you're from the Ukraine, which I can't tell the difference. But what the difference is, and this is kind of where I want to go with our conversation next. Because we are talking here about philosophies, or religions, if you will, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I want to throw one other thing out there before we dive into this this aspect of sameness and differences. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of people in this country claiming that they do not want Sharia law in America. And I don't know that much about it. All I know is, okay, Sharia law. Sharia is obviously a different form of law based on religion. And yet I constantly hear the phrase that the United States was founded on Judeo-Christian foundation, religion, which means that our laws are religiously based, and that people, they don't want to be under a religious legal system like Sharia law. It seems to me like we're already there, not Sharia law, but we're under religious law. And it's like, we're already there in that respect. And maybe Sharia law is much more extreme, and, you know, the penalties are much harsher than what we have in this country. But you see, the principle is sort of the same. And I always found that really, really rather interesting. But what are the differences that you see, the main, I don't know, top three, top five differences that create the greatest tension between these three, and I'm going to use the phrase, these three great faiths?
Yes. You know, the... If they look at the, this is just gets behind why you can't tell the difference when you have a Muslim, Jew, Christian, Arab, you know, Jew or a Christian from different countries together coming from the Holy Land. And a friend of mine, a Jewish man from a scientist from Tel Aviv, did a report, took over several years and studied the genome of the people in the Holy Land, and found that the Palestinians and Israeli Jews, Christians, people in the Holy Land had a very similar genome. So they say they came all from the same genetic source. So one reason why you can't tell the difference is that they, have the same genetic makeup, they look alike. Then, of course, people living in the area see the detail, how they speak and so forth. They can tell right away the distinctions among and between the Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Like getting to the Sharia law, if you look at the based upon the Quran, and you look at the mitzvahs, Jewish law, based mm-hmm. on the Torah and the Talmud, as well as the Muslim law based upon the Hadith, you find that many of the rules are very similar. Then you look at the Christian rules coming from the Bible, New and Old Testament, on which our country was based. After all, Sunday, the Sabbath day, was considered essentially a day of rest, but it was also the Sabbath for Christians. We don't have Shabbat in the United States, as you do in Israel, where from sunset to Friday to sunup, sunset Saturday, you have, everything is pretty well closed and you have the Shabbat. So, I mean, it's very similar Sharia law to the rule. In general, I mean,
in a general sense, yeah.
In a general sense, they're based upon the Ten Commandments, and so forth. Then you get into the detail, and you see that strict Sharia law, like Saudi Arabia applies, and the Taliban even perhaps stricter, and probably ISIS, the so-called caliphate, even stricter than that. When you are judged a thief, they can cut off a hand and so forth. To them, this is normal. And if a woman, for instance, has sex outside of marriage, whether she be married or not, she can be stoned to death, and other things like that in their culture, is that for them it's normal. And I can understand why Americans, why would they even ask the question, though, Richard? Why would they even say, we don't want Sharia law applied in the United States? I'm not sure why they would even ask that question. What's the risk of it? There are some Muslim communities that want Sharia law. I don't know where that's coming from.
Well, it's because of the supposed influx, not only influx, but also conversion by many people for a myriad of different reasons. For example, I shared with you, and I've shared on this program before, I became a member of the Baha'i Faith and realized after a year and a half that I had joined because I was looking for a group that would accept me. Not because I believed in the tenets of the faith, and I loved them. They were wonderful. I thought there was a wonderful, peace-loving philosophy. But I couldn't stay in that philosophy as a member in good standing because I felt I had joined under false pretenses. I don't know enough about the Muslim faith. And of course, I've even grappled with the concept, the conversation of, do we call it the Muslim faith? Do we call it Islam? What's the difference? Does it matter which one I use, which word I use to describe that philosophy? And so on and so forth. The one thing that I really, really appreciated of the Baha'i faith was in reference to the various messengers of the different philosophies down through the centuries, that when you reject one of God's messengers, you reject them all. And when you accept one of God's messengers, you accept them all. And I thought that makes pretty good sense to me, because if you're just trying to live a good life and be kind to your fellow human beings, how could you go wrong with any of them, really? But I feel such a void in my life, not knowing about many of these different philosophies and their tenets, as I know about Christianity in particular, and to a lesser degree, Judaism. It's like I feel, and I can't necessarily blame the educational system or my family or anything. It's entirely up to me what I choose to learn. But I hear from people from other parts of the world. We have exchange students that come to Santa Barbara to study, and I find out that they know 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 different languages. That's the norm in Europe, in particular, and that they learn about all these other cultures because they're surrounded by them. But the United States seems to want to isolate itself from them and not get to know. The people I met in the Baha'i faith, they came from the part of the Middle East they referred to more as as Persia. And these were the most gentle, loving, kind-hearted individuals you'd ever want to meet. It was so wonderful. And so we're doing programs over the course of the next year or two. We're going to be doing programs, bringing in, if I could get a hold of an imam, to have him come in and dialogue about the tenets of the faith that is founded on the teachings of Muhammad, I would love to do that. I've had rabbis on this program. I've had atheists on this program, and we've talked about their level of spirituality and morality as well. And they don't have a founder, per se. I even had Scientologists on this program. I didn't mention that it was Scientology we were talking about until the end, because I knew that somebody listening, knowing, oh, he's talking about Scientology, I'm going to turn it off. It's like, how do we expand to then understand those mindsets you are talking about, Frank, if we don't expand? I mean, it boggles my mind.
Well, first of all, my father was a Baha'i. After World War II, he was a soldier fighting the Japanese, and he saw a lot of violence and a lot of death. And when he returned, and considering what happened in World War II and the European front, so we need to have world unity. And that was the underpinning idea of the beginning of the United Nations. And he loved that idea, and the United Nations recommended, people in the United recommended, you know, there is a religion, the Baha'i religion, that believes in harmony of religions, like you expressed about the messengers. And my dad became a member. He also, for different reasons, did not stay a member. He had a moral sympathy and feeling for that religion. But it's interesting, though, Richard, in these events that I started initiating in 2005, when I talk about interfaith events, and I started out in a kibbutz in northern Israel, and I met a lady who was very progressive, who in her kibbutz organized meetings once a month with Muslim, Jews, Christians, where they would talk together, eat together, sing and pray and things like that. And the third visit that I was going about once a month there, and she helped me organize one of these. And I said, I come from the United States, and many, many Americans don't understand the distinction. It's even difficult to talk with an American who understands his or her own religion, really, have really read the Bible and understand it. But here in the Holy Land, it's no exception to the extent that Muslim, Jews, and Christians are exposed to different religions, just like, and themselves, as well as just like in Europe, where Europeans are exposed to so many languages, and out of obligation, you think that they learn those languages, and they do. But here, I'm not so convinced that part of the issue in the Holy Land is that Muslims don't understand about Judaism and Christianity. Yeah, and even though you're there and exposed to it, you've got the holy sites. So this is what I want to do in this next interfaith group. I want to start out, do a meditation. I don't usually start out with a specific Christian, Muslim, or Jewish meditation. It's an interfaith thing, and can vary, spiritually generic. I'm not talking about Jesus, the Son of God, just talking about God and so forth, the principles that all three religions accept. And then right after that, I would like someone, an imam or just a Muslim, to explain for 5 minutes, 5 minutes, the principles of Islam, and someone explain the principle of Judaism, and someone, another, and a Jew, and then a Christian explain the principles of Christ. So we get back down to understanding what the principles are, and then we can flow on the focus on the similarities without ignoring the differences. And so even in the Holy Land, Richard, there still is a lack of information, even though they're really exposed to their religions, their religious sites. And the United States is historically, and it's part of our education system, they feel that we're so isolated, and yet it's true. And if you're in France, in Germany, you're surrounded by different languages and cultures. But the United States has this perspective, which is an illusion, that we're isolated, that we're surrounded. If we extend our thinking. And who does it? We bridge our isolationist thinking with teachers that have a more realistic understanding of the world, that we're not that far away from different cultures, and it doesn't matter because of internet and everything. We are as close, imagine, as close to these different cultures and languages as the Europeans are, and you need to broaden your thinking because English won't work everywhere, and understanding people's cultures, religious culture and otherwise, is essential for communication. So I think the United States is just I received a very poor public school education. I think that's somehow evolving. They talked about charter schools, but we are, historically one country. We spend a lot of money on education. One of the, they say about the top, the low 10% of quality in our public schools, the bottom 5 to 10%, and yet we spend probably top 10% in money for various reasons. We need to change our education. You hit upon it, Richard, big time, that we need to evolve our thinking. It's not just about our geography. There are no geography limitations anymore with the internet and so forth, and travel and all the time, and planes and exchange programs, exchange in the schools and businesses. It's become a global world. We need to start thinking globally, starting from the roots up, from our education up, how we educate our children, ourselves, and move forward and break out of this isolationist thinking. English, we only need English type of thinking in America before, and with this hyper-patriotism, which doesn't only exist in the United States. I see it mm-hmm. in some European countries. I see it in some Arab countries. And that serves often as a smokescreen between ourselves and the reality. But what you're hitting upon, we need to work on, Richard, especially understanding the different religions too. I take knee-jerk. Anytime I take a knee-jerk approach, it's because I think, well, I know. I've got the emotion behind it, and I know. It's because, on the contrary, I don't know. And I'm focusing on kind of like a reaction, a kind of a reflex reaction founded on my emotion and not upon fact or research. And I've stopped myself. I've been able to do that more and more now, Richard, and I think it has a lot to do with so many of my knee-jerk approach and so many of my first impressions, so many of my ideas have been shot down by the reality I see and hear and talk with people. And I've learned to be more objective in that way, thanks to my trips and so forth. But, you don't need to. I've met a lot of people who have not, and I'll stop there because I want to hear from you, I've spoken with a lot of people who've never traveled, who have a very clear view of the world because they're open-minded. They think, they reflect, they have a strong education. So you don't really need necessarily travel as I do. It helps sometimes to get yourself into that mindset better. But if you're just around us, we can learn so much. And then we have global connections to education through internet and so forth. There are things we can do and be very much aware of what's going on without even traveling.
We're talking with Frank Romano here on the program about love and terror in the Middle East, and it does seem that there is a mixture of the two. We're trying to set aside the latter if we can. Someday maybe we will reach that level, and we're going to keep working at it until we get there, one way or the other. Frank, stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World.
All right.
I'm Richard Dugan. Don't go away. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us and staying with us here on the program. It's certainly, there's no question, this is a conversation that can get rather controversial, and I just want to let our listeners know that I am trying to understand. I mean, absolutely no disrespect whatsoever to anyone of faith or whatever your positions might be. I'm trying to get a better grip. If for example, when we started out in our last segment using an analogy that may or may not apply, well, it's because I don't have the full understanding of what's going on. And I'm trying to get that as much as possible. That's why we use, I think, an apropos analogy, that there's this circle and there's an event taking place within the center of this circle. And it is our job as real honest individuals, human beings, to move from point to point on that circle, looking at that event from as many points on the circle as we can, to get the best fullest understanding of what is happening before we pass judgment, before we, take action and do something that, you know, who knows, we might regret doing and being involved in, down the road. And again, I know, Frank, that we're all filled with, great passion and conviction on so many different things. And I'm curious, as we continue on here, why do you even care? Why don't you just let these people alone and go be a lawyer in the United States and try cases and win and make lots of money and just live a nice, peaceful life, Frank? Why?
No, but your question is absolutely relevant, Richard. I was a fairly successful lawyer in San Francisco, even just out of the starting blocks. And my wife at the time was a buyer and seller at Levi Strauss. We were living the Dolce Vita in North Beach in San Francisco, had our kids. And then, but I've had this calling to go back to Europe and then eventually go to the Middle East and do my interfaith work. And then we get to Paris. Didn't quite get to the Middle East yet. I get my PhD. I've got a tenured teaching job in one of these most beautiful cities and culturally motivating cities in the entire world. And we had pretty much the good life there. And going back and forth to San Francisco, getting the best of both worlds, and my kids getting public school education there is amazing. Compared to our public schools, and they're learning French. What got me into the war zone, into the Holy Land? Well, it came from a 30-year experience. 30 years ago, I was a young, not married student, just struggling in Paris, studying philosophy. And I go to these amazing lectures, which I didn't understand a lot. My French wasn't still that good enough, but it was so motivating. I was starting to think for the first time in my life. I've never really questioned things. But I was living the bohemian lifestyle and what they called the servants' quarters, way up above the apartment. A lot of these apartment buildings, these exclusive apartment buildings in Paris, had servants' quarters that the servants used to live in, and some still do. And the students pretty well have rented them. But I was isolated from people, and this is a big city, Paris, and the subways day in and day out. I mean, you can go as a tourist and just see beautiful things and cafes and the Seine and the Champs-Élysées. When you're living there on a day-to-day basis, it's a real grind, like New York and subways, and people are tough, and I was getting depressed. And so in depression, sometimes you do find enlightenment. Anyway, I prayed and I meditated, and the calling was, I got from the meditation prayer, was to get out of Paris and leave my job. I was a waiter at a petit déjeuner restaurant, a breakfast restaurant, and I took off. And I didn't have enough money to take a plane from Paris into the Middle East, so I took a train and all the way down to the border and switched trains in Spain to the southern part of Spain, then across from Algeciras, Spain, into Tangier. And now I'm in Morocco, and the next plan was to get across. I didn't have a lot of money, so I was going to hitchhike and work, take me 2 months to get across the Sinai into Israel, into the West Bank, and do this. The calling was to do this kind of interfaith work. And this was in 1978. And I met an imam of a mosque in Casablanca, where I was actually crashed in the street. And he turns to me and says, "What are you doing sleeping in the streets like a dog? Come into the mosque, learn about Islam." And of course, that was on my list to do, because I knew I didn't know anything about Islam, and I wanted to work with Muslims, Jews, in particular Muslims, Jews, and Christians, other faiths as well. And I went into the mosque, and it was this huge, beautiful mosque with birds nesting in the rafters above, and a cool breeze, and these men with beards and white pearl white jalabiyas, and I thought I was like, these men were descended from heaven like prophets. But it was really the wrong mosque to learn Islam in. It turned out to be a jihadist group. They wouldn't let me go after a week. They told me, "Look, we want you to convert you to this is for your own good, and then we want you to help recruit for us." Recruiting, I thought the armies did. Anyway, it was a Wahhabi or Salafi group implanted in Morocco to convert the Moroccans to an extremist form of Islam. The only way out was to escape and return to Paris without getting without continuing my trip. I got help. I escaped and got back to Paris, then back to the States. And I'm fast forwarding. After that, I became a lawyer, and then I returned. Now I'm back in Paris, where I talked about before, teaching and, you know, the good life. But I still had that desire to go to the Middle East, and wondering if that original dream I had was a true calling or just another of my fantasies. And so I took a plane this time, 3 hours, I took, you know, just a 3-hour flight from Paris to Tel Aviv, and starting in 2005. And it's been magical. I realized that, no, this is a true calling. At the time, I was a lawyer as well, and I gave up all litigation, because you can't litigate. You have to be in the courts with your clients 24/7 a lot of times when you're a litigator. I had to give that up. I held on to my professor job, which gives me a kind of a modest salary, but it allows me to pay my bills and to travel a bit. And then here I am now in the West Bank in Israel, meeting people. And it's all chronicled in the book Love and Terror in the Middle East, and it's been magical ever since. So the original, to answer your question, Richard, the original motivation came from that trip to Morocco, and to completing it was what I'm doing now. And it's not completed. Every year, I just got back a month ago. There was a huge issue in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, that we talked about, and it was a nonviolent protest that the Palestinians wanted the Israeli government to withdraw from their mosque, which is the third most sacred part of Islam. I got involved in this. It got kind of push and shovey. I got hospitalized. It all worked out. And the state of Israel did release the mosque, and the Muslims were able to return to their mosque. So it's an ongoing thing. But I realized, Richard, that through my efforts and other people's efforts, that it's the grassroots, nonviolent, peace-loving, to the extent we're working together with different groups, and we want, you know, people to get together and to talk and understand their religions and then do projects together. That the real bonding is not the talking. There's a lot of talking, not enough people walking the talk. And so we'll go in, and for instance, when the yeshiva was destroyed in Bethlehem, which is a Jewish school, we go back and we rebuild it together. Who? Muslim, Jews, Christians, agnostics, atheists, Buddhists, Hindus, you know, a mixed bunch of people. And while we are doing things like pass the navel, the nails, we'll smoke some hookah, we'll go to lunch, we're bonding stronger than just talking about peace and love. We're actually acting it out, doing stuff. And we turn this yeshiva into an international school where everyone come and study different things, not just about religion. And then I also go back and forth and participate in the olive harvest of Palestinians actions, where we're bonding together. With whom do I do the olive harvest? Muslims, Jews, Christians, people from all over the world, in solidarity with Palestinians to help them harvest their olives, because that's the most important revenue. And a lot of their children, a lot of their family are in jail, unfortunately, due to this situation. And so this all comes together as an answer to your question, what motivates me? It's not in charity, or I see a part of the world that needs help and I'm going there to give them charity. It's actually a calling I've had, and I'm just trying to be faithful to that calling.
You know, there are a lot of symbols, too, that represent, and again, I bring up the Muslim faith because of the lack of knowledge and awareness. When I see the cross, I know what that means. I know what it represents. I was taught that. When I see the Star of David, I have sort of kind of an understanding of what that's about and why it is that it is. I have no clue as to the Star and Crescent, as to why it's the Star and Crescent. But it was interesting, because as I was scrolling through some information, I came across a minimum of 12 national flags that use the Star and Crescent in their design. And many of these countries I've heard the names of, but unless I read the content of the information, I have no clues to where they are. I mean, they're not here. I know that much. They're not here in the Western Hemisphere. And I might take a wild guess and say they're in the Northern Hemisphere, on the other side of the Earth. You know, so I'm close. And I think that's one of the other aspects. And I probably could agree with you that my education was abysmal as a kid growing up, because I didn't learn a lot about mythology, which I find fascinating. I didn't learn a lot about comparative religions, which, again, I find fascinating as to what the contents of those faiths, those philosophies are. But again, here we go back to the symbols and so forth. When you look at these three symbols, what is it that they are saying to you?
Yeah, the well, of course, we know what the cross means. The king, the Star of David. You know, David was helped mobilize the Jewish people in the Kingdom of David. And it's interesting when I go to Hebron, where he apparently was very active there in Hebron, in the West Bank, as one of the seats of his kingdom. They've made that star was David was symbolized his kingdom. Now, you brought something up that I feel equally kind of in the dark about. I'm not sure exactly why they selected King David. There's also King Solomon. Why, you know, King David? Why the Star of David? Why the 6 points? It's a six-pointed star, not five, not ten.
Right.
I don't know. And I'm beginning to think I need to do more research about it because I am Jewish roots. And I'll go and I'll pray in the synagogues as well as I do in the churches as well as in the mosques. But and I see the Star of David and I brought Star of David for one of my daughters, and yet I'm not quite sure. And equally, I feel equally in the dark about the symbol of the sickle and the crescent for the Muslims. And I can read the Quran. I understand a lot of the fundamental and the fundamentalist aspect of Islam and the liberal aspect. I mean, it's just a mixture, and try to get behind some of the suicide and bombing and all this and why they think it's justified and all the issues around the Quran. And yet I don't know what that symbolized that mean. Maybe the next time we talk, I should do some research and we can talk more about it. I can share with you the difference in the doctrine and why extremists feel that they can base what they're doing on the Quran and how it is taking things out of context. Why also extremist Jews, the settlers, continue taking Palestinian lands. And they base it on the Torah, they base it on the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, and specifically, and how we get into that. I think they take that also out of context and a misinterpretation, as well as you can look at the Christians, during the Inquisition and during the Crusades, and also, well, these are extremist Christians that believe in life, the right to life, that go as far as blow up abortion clinics in the United States and kill a lot of people, ironically. Basing what they're doing on text, on biblical text, which I think is probably misinterpreted and taken out of context. I can do that. We can go into the text because we do it all the time in our interfaith groups because we get into a discussion about ideology. Not always. I try to avoid that and not talk about politics. Just talk about us as human beings. And I'll give you an example of an interfaith group, a typical one, I try to just kind of shift it away from the real sensitive issues that we'll get into them, but I don't know about the symbols, and I'm embarrassed that I don't know enough about. But maybe next time I'll study them. I focus. I it's almost like I don't see the forest. I don't know that, but I go into the text itself, into the minute detail that I can't read Hebrew, but I can read Arabic, and because it's essential, even though I do say Hebrew prayers phonetically when I go into the synagogue, according to my roots, I do know well, the Muslim prayers, and I've had to learn Arabic because the Palestinians being so isolated, they can't speak English very well, and to communicate with them, I've had to learn Arabic. But so the Arabic and the text, some of the minute details we get into, but the symbols I'm not so strong on, and I'm embarrassed about that.
Well, no worries there, because I don't either. And the fact of the matter is that that's the whole point of all of this is to learn.
It is important.
You understand the symbols, when you understand the symbols, that gives you a greater understanding of the mindset. It really does. I was actually going through some other aspects too. For example, I was reading about myths. Speaking of mythology, myths about Muslims. One of them is that they say they worship a moon god. Not true. Muslims don't believe in Jesus. Not true. A matter of fact, I remember hearing many, many years ago, someone was sharing with me something from the Quran. Or maybe I was reading some other book, and they made reference to this. that in the Quran, it is said that Muhammad basically said to his followers, protect the people of the book. Well, there was only one faith at the time of Muhammad that had a book in this context, and that was the Christians. And so that's why I when I hear about all of this stuff about getting rid, you know, getting rid of the non-believers from the Muslim perspective, I'm thinking, but wait a minute. But Muhammad said you're supposed to protect the Christians. I'm a Christian. I consider myself such. Aren't you supposed to protect me and not kill me?
Sorry, the people of the book, just and continue this thought. I just want to interject.
Yeah.
The people of the book were referred to both as Christians and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
They are the people of the book. But go ahead, please.
Well, you're absolutely right, because the Torah was the book of the Jews.
Yes.
That most Muslims are Arab. Not true. That Islam oppresses women. And again, we make these assumptions based upon some of the media information that is put out without actually doing any real investigation, without doing any kind of research into some of these things. And
and as an example, it's interesting because I always thought that it was Islam, the way it was, the Quran was interpreted, and it was the way Quran is interpreted, that the women in Palestine were not equal and fighting for their rights and often obligated to stay at home and not go to the university, even those that wanted to. And unless the women find equality, I still believe that even though there will be someday a state for the Palestinians, there'll be freedom and this occupation will be gone and the blockade against Gaza also. I spoke with a professor at Birzeit University. I just went there not long ago. I was an invited guest to the Birzeit University, and that's a very famous university in the West Bank. And we went through the Quran, and he showed me that Muhammad believed in total equality of women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why their society was so advanced years back, far more advanced than the Europe that was in the Middle Ages. One of the reasons why. But and it's these interpretations that you allude to, Richard, by some of these, in particular these extremist groups, Orthodox Muslim extremist groups of the Quran, that to them justify the oppression of women, that they're second class, the fact that they stay at home, and there's a double standard when it comes to ultramarital sex and things like this, are apparently, according to this person. I need to do more research as well. According to this professor, it was not at all in line with the teachings of Muhammad. So, when we get into my groups, and I have like from 10 to 15 people, sometimes fewer, this is how it works. We'll have an interfaith group, and we'll get into the text maybe later, but we'll have an interfaith group with Muslims, Jews, Christians, Baha'is, Buddhists, Hindus, atheists, agnostics, and Sufis, Druze, and so forth. I'll just get together and we'll eat and we'll just listen to music or something. And then in the middle of the meeting, I'll look over and I'll see a Jewish man talking. I'm an Orthodox Jew. He's got the side curls and the tzitzits hanging down and the yarmulke or that hat, the Seder hat they wear. The Orthodox Muslim with his keffiyeh, right, and jalaba. And they're talking to each other. And I said, wow, what's up? And they're saying, well, we have something in common. I said, wow, well, what's that? Please share with us. I said, well, we live in separate villages in Israel, but our kids go to a third school in a village. They go to the same school. Are they talking, well, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Jew and all? No, they're talking, well, the price of lunch went up. The sociology teacher's kind of weird, everyday things. And they're linking this way. And I'll ask the Christian, hey, Harold, what do you think of what that? And he said, I think it's cool. In fact, the Muslim, Muhammad, has invited us all to break the fast tonight, Ramadan. And during Hanukkah, we're going to go visit the home of the Jew. And during Christmas, I'm inviting them all to my home. Even though we're not going to focus on religion, I'm just going to share that with them. But I said, but what but could there be? He said, they don't accept Jesus as their savior. See, and now that opens up the Pandora's box. Now the Muslims intervenes and says, well, they don't understand Muhammad the way I do. And the Jew says, and they don't send the Torah. And I says, I don't know. And they're alluding to the fact that they love each other. Really, they've really bonded. And yet they think the others are going to hell and they want them to kind of come their way in their religious thinking. I said, I don't know who's going to heaven or hell. I pick up my Torah and my Koran. And I says, let's figure out what's similar. And I'm going to show the text to you. It shows in the Koran, the Old New Testament, thou shalt not kill, treat your neighbors with respect, help the poor, and so forth. And I said, you know, you've got a lot in common. Are you so convinced now that you're going to heaven, the others are going to hell? And now there's hesitation. Mm. And, you know, and then I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave you with one final question. I'll be back. This is an ongoing dialogue. We'll be somewhere else. We'll have other people there. Does it make sense then? One other question. You at first were adamant that you don't even share the same God, and now you're thinking, well, you've got so many similar principles, it's possible. And I said, well, let's leave this possibility with you in the form of a question. Does it make sense to kill in the name of God if you share the same God? So think about that. We'll be back. So we'll get into the text, and we can. I don't know how much more time we have, Richard, but this is sort of like how the interfaith thing goes, and then we'll get into the religious, because someone will bring it up, and I'll go as far as they want to go, mm-hmm. as far as my knowledge, and then hopefully we'll have some biblical experts and some Quranic experts to jump in there, mm-hmm. So those people who know the Hadith for Muslim or the Talmud. And the oral tradition of Judaism, and we can go on and on and just reveal, you know, things about the ideal and understand it together. Coming from someone who they care about makes a huge difference in this communication and is bringing people. And then we'll go off and do these projects because we've bonded. And this Muslim, for instance, said, you know, I never, you know, we've been living together in separate villages, but I asked this Jew, I had an administrative problem. Because it's, you know, often the Jews are privileged in Israel. There's a double standard, clearly, Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And he asked the Jew to help him to work out, get his visa papers for a member of his family coming from another country. And he worked with it. And he had me come over and help build his fence. We're helping each other. We're like brothers now.
Yeah.
You know, and just doing stuff together, not just talking about peace. So much talk, talk, talk. And they're actually doing something, getting in there. And all I am then is a facilitator. And again, these events and things I've done, even some of the marches are in Lebanon or in the Middle East, and I'm still working on, you know, going back and forth. I'm a facilitator. That's my role. That's my calling. And I see a need for it on the grassroots efforts, and I see it taking hold. But you know what, Richard? Taking hold. I mean, more and more people are getting involved in this, which I think is essential for durable peace in the Holy Land, is coming from the people, grassroots efforts. And sooner or later, the politicians and the religious leaders will follow the will of the people that want peace, that are tired of the bloodshed, just like in Ireland. And they start laying down arms, which they did in Ireland, start integrating the political system for hundreds of years at each other's throats. It's a different situation in the Middle East, but in that regard, analogous. Yet the Palestinians and Israelis have not laid down arms yet. They haven't got to that. They have got to the level of being so disgusted over the atrocities on all sides, so they're following a much longer evolution, but it's spirited by the people, and that's what I get involved in. And this type of information, that's why I'm out here doing the author of it. I should be back to the Middle East. I should also be teaching my courses. I'm going to arrive two weeks late, but I've got permission to do that. Well, I sort of take that I authorize myself because I have tenure and they can't get rid of me to spend time with Americans. Because I see, you know, there's a growing movement worldwide, grassroots efforts. Americans are getting involved, and it's worth doing it. It's not about book sales. The book selling and these events don't even cover half my costs. The royalties I get don't cover half my costs. The point is just getting out there, talking with people, connecting with people, and getting my publicists involved, who the Ascot Media, connecting with you, Richard, and you providing a great venue to spread the word, and listening to what you have to say on the air is why I'm here.
You know, when I was working for the religious station, a conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist type of format, and of course, when I first started working there, and of course, being born and raised Roman Catholic, had all of that wonderful indoctrination, and I kept hearing from each of the diverse perspectives that, Christianity is the only way. And I remember hearing the biblical passage about how, let us sit and reason together. Well, what part of your, anatomy, if you will, do you use to reason? Well, you use your brain. And so I got to thinking about that comment that this is the only way to heaven, to God and what have you. And I thought, okay, well, let me run something by you here. Let's see. As a human being on this planet, I have the opportunity to experience a myriad, quite literally, probably millions of different kinds of foods and drink. And that I can, and I'm encouraged to do so, go in pretty much any direction that I want educationally and in a career. I can marry or not marry anybody that I want, especially today. I can live pretty much anywhere that I want, obviously with all of the wonderful other little caveats. And right. And so I have all of these choices, which is what this program is all about. And then you tell me that there's only one way to God? That doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense. And I can understand people becoming vested in their philosophy. Yes. I can certainly appreciate that. I've never followed one individual or one particular group. Yes, I was a Baha'i for a year and a half. I was Roman Catholic, practicing probably till I was in my 20s or 30s when I married at 23. My first wife was of the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church, Byzantine, still under the Pope, not Orthodox, and I loved it. It was beautiful. I still have actually one of the books of liturgy that's in Slavonic, which is the language that they said the Mass in predominantly. I have been exposed to a lot of different philosophies, not only through this program, but also just through my interactions from in my day-to-day life. And all I know is that there are so many different ways of being in this life, and of being a kind and honorable and integral and compassionate individual to both self, and especially to self and to others. Quite honestly, I think that was a beautiful example that you shared of these individuals from the different faiths, in spite of their differing philosophical mindsets, they still came together to be together with one another. It's really extraordinary. We are, of course, talking with Frank Romano. He is the author of a book entitled Love and Terror in the Middle East, and we're going to continue that conversation here on the program. We encourage you to touch base with Frank. His website is Frank Romano, that's FrankRomano, Love and Terror, all one word, and the number 4, Love and Terror, number 4, and that's Frank Romano Love and Terror number 4. We encourage you to check that website out as well, and we certainly hope that you will investigate further on this particular subject. It's extremely important for all of us, not just in terms of maybe solving the crises in the Middle East and in other areas, but in our own lives, So when you modify belief systems, Frank, and again, my guest is Frank Romano. He's the author of Love and Terror in the Middle East. Please go to that website address I just gave you to check out all of the good information he has available. We've got a lot of diverse philosophies out there, and people are just trying to make their way through life and hopefully in a peaceful way as much as they can. But of course, we do run across people that are very vested in their philosophical bents. I've never really latched onto one specific, because it's kind of what I said to my sister one day. She's part of a very fundamentalist group outside the Catholic Church, and I said to her one evening when we were chatting about my beliefs, and she was real worried about me and my salvation. I said, "Look, my beliefs are not my beliefs of yesterday are not my beliefs of today are not my beliefs of tomorrow because I'm constantly experiencing and growing and learning, and trying to understand." And that's, I think, one of the things that you are trying to do, that you are doing, and you are trying to also foster in other people. And it sounds to me like on a one-to-one basis, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, you're having, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, you're having some pretty good success in spite of the bumps and bruises you've gotten along the way.
Yes, and, you know, we get into the, you know, we see that when that Christian in the group says, well, people don't believe in, you know, that Jesus is their Savior, we'll get into an ideology there. And then we'll expand our thinking, we'll grow together. And I think for that reason, because they're talking and bonding, there is progress being made. But I feel that we're planting seeds, Richard. I don't think any monumental changes are going to take place during our generation, but planting seeds that the youth are picking it up and taking it from there. I believe that your children, my children, our children's children will see a whole new architecture of the Holy Land. If this grassroots efforts, you know, a true, sincere desire to bring people together and make it a better world, you know, if it continues and the activists don't give up. What I will predict, though, if the Holy Land does not find a durable peace, there are always warmongers no matter where you are, mm-hmm. but if they find a durable peace, which is sort of like the situation in Ireland where it's not perfect, or in South Africa, but it's work, they're making it happen. If they don't find it, the world will remain at war, because this happens to be, and I don't still understand why, the Holy Land is an epicenter for world peace and or world conflict. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about, the beauty of the diversity, and, you know, we're so different. We have different things and different philosophies, yet there are different ways to approach different things, and just to expand our thinking, understanding that unconditional love first, that we bond and love each other, and which motivates us to find out about each other. What about then the Orthodox Jew in a settlement that tries to run us over in a car because one of my friends is wearing a cross when we're in Hebron on a peace march? Mm-hmm. What about this man? We'll get together and talk. He says, look, the Torah tells us that this is our land, and we're the children of Israel. We're the chosen few, and we're to go into Samaria and Judea. That happens to be the West Bank, to kick out all the non-Jews. And we're doing that now. We are atoning for the sin that we committed in biblical times. The Jews did not obey God. We intermarried with Canaanites, and we regretted it. But now we're atoning for our sin. And then we'll get in a group, and then someone will pipe up and say, well, Maimonides, a famous Jewish scholar, you know him. Yes, and we all love him. Jews, Orthodox, liberal alike, said, well, these orders of God don't necessarily pass from one generation to the other, but let us assume it does. Let us assume that you are following, you're obeying God. But there's a more important mitzvah. The Jews follow 613 mitzvahs, and there's a hierarchy. One of the most important mitzvah, perhaps more important than any other, is treat your neighbors with respect. It's one of the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament, talked about, of course, by Jesus and also in the Quran, that you would be violating, aren't you? You're in a settlement, you're kicking out the non-Jews, and you're not treating your neighbors with respect who've been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And so then at that point, he doesn't want to talk to us anymore. So here we get into that fact. And then let's put it together with born-again Christians or Messianic Christians believe totally in what Israel is doing. They believe that the Jews have to return to the Holy Land to maintain their state before the second coming of the Messiah for them. And I'm saying, but if you are, and they're in the settlements a lot, they bankroll a lot of the settlements, American, Messianic Jews, born-again Christians that believe that theory. And I'm saying, but you are supporting a people, including the unbridled support of the U.S., that are persecuting Palestinians, violating a most important Ten Commandment. How do you justify that? So, you know, this is sort of the discourse, Richard, in getting involved in underlying principles that we share and sort of distorting what we're doing to serve our particular goal at the expense of other human beings. I think we can overcome that. Another success is through dialogue, where even though that Orthodox settler Jew will not change overnight, he'll think about it. He'll come back. And some of these Orthodox settler Jews are now talking with some of the Palestinian NGOs about a one-state solution. In other words, allowing the Palestinians to return to their land, not having the Israeli government reimburse them, but allowing them have access to all of Israel, not just the West Bank, where they can only go because there's borders and they can't get out of the West Bank, most Palestinians, but allow them to get into Israel too, be Israeli citizens. And if they have deeds to their land in Haifa, where the Baha'i, center is, yeah, or in Tel Aviv, they still have deeds to their land, and yet they're in refugee camps. They can't go back to their lands because the state of Israel prevents them, and settlers are in their lands that they have deeds to. They are the owners of those lands. They will be compensated. They will allow access to all of Israel, but they cannot get back those lands. That would be impossible. But at least they're talking about it. These Israeli settlers are talking about it. So there is progress being made through these interfaith efforts, I believe, and that's one indication.
Well, Counselor, since you opened the door, and we're just about out of time, since you opened the door to the Irish connection, I'm going to quote a line from a wonderful Irish song in reference to land. You don't own the land. The land owns you. And I will say somewhat flippantly here, no disrespect to Israelis or Palestinians, that my solution would be that both of you have to leave. Nobody gets the land. It will stay vacant for time immemorial. And that'll fix both your little red wagons. But again, I say that flippantly. Frank, I want to thank you so much for sharing
thank
so much
you very
time.
Much.
I have three more questions that I'd like to ask you before we wrap up, and also invite you, should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, to come into the studio. We'd love to continue this conversation.
Oh, I'd love to, yes. I will be actually in Riverside for a conference. They're actually featuring me with a study group, book group, Riverside's not around the corner, but I'm headed that way in January, and just have events going all the way through the area, including down in Santa Barbara. It's not at the end of the world, so I might be able to see you, and if you're there in January, I might be able to come by.
Would love it. Would love to do that.
Okay.
And again, I'll let our listeners know that the website, I encourage you folks to go and check out more information about Love and Terror in the Middle East, and it's the fourth edition. It is Frank Romano loveandterror4.com. Frank Romano loveandterror4.com. Frank, before we let you go, first question of the three is, who is Frank Romano?
I was born and raised where I was born and raised, and I was born in Oregon, raised in California. And there I studied, and I came from immigrant, my father's side, immigrant Italian, and then traced our roots to Jewish roots on my mother's side, British American. Ethel May Robinette was actually a famous Shakespearean actress at the Ashland Shakespearean Theater Company in 1940. So those are my roots, and then I went to Paris to study, as I reflected in what I was saying, and then I went back again in 93. After I had taken that trip to Morocco, this time married with kids and got my doctorate, and then I finally started going back and forth in the Middle East to follow that calling, which about the interfaith stuff that's chronicled in Love and Terror in the Middle East. And so me, I'm just an everyday guy. I mean, I spent years working on farms in Northern California and got this desire to work in law, and I wanted to work as a delinquent lawyer because I was working with very dangerous delinquent criminals as a counselor, and I realized that they didn't need shrinks as much as they need a good lawyer, and that got me back into school, law school, and I internationalized my motivation, and then I enhanced that by what I do in the Middle East and Morocco. So that, but my roots are pretty modest. I mean, I did a lot of trade work, a lot of farm work, and I was a certified welder. So I come from pretty, modest roots. My parents were professionals, but I'm pretty basic guy, nothing special, just motivated to try to do something in my corner of the world.
And speaking of which, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Yeah, the main thing I want to do is encourage everyone to follow your passion, to find out, take the time through prayer, meditation. What are you here? Everyone is here for a purpose. Everyone can contribute. And I don't have a monopoly in how to do that, you know, following my footsteps to Morocco. And that's just the path I took, but I highly recommend and try to motivate people to follow your passion and work hard. There's no mystery to it. It's going to take hard work, staying close to that passion. Everyone has the calling. And then I'd like to branch that out. And my calling specifically is for a durable peace in the Holy Land as a manifestation of who I am and what I believe in, and that I'm willing to take necessary risk, which is another theme I try to motivate people. Sometimes you got to take necessary risks to achieve your goal mm-hmm. and to follow your passion.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life purpose is to, first of all, find out who I am, in some way make it a better world, but first of all, clean up my garden, and I'm still working on it, to make myself one with the universe, one with mankind, one with nature, and then spread out, find out why I'm here, and then go forward.
I want to thank you again for sharing so much time with us here on the program. Frank Romano, and again, the title of the book is Love and Terror in the Middle East, and it's the fourth edition. And we encourage you to check out his website. We'll be linked to it as well. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.